everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where one writer talks to another writer about the books we write and the lives we lead and how these two are one in the same. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as audio and video interviews with best-selling and award-winning writers across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org, and we are funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. To learn more about the PNWA, as well as their wonderful yearly writers' conference, please go to pnwa.org. You know, I learned to tell stories, really, by sitting around my family's living room and trying to entertain my brother and sister and my mom, and of course by reading novel after novel as a boy and a young man. But I really feel that I learned how to write, to really write, when I discovered poetry. It was poetry that taught me the power of economy, and it was poetry that taught me to relate to language the way a composer would relate to sound and the way a painter would relate to paint and to image. And it's for this reason that I'm so thrilled to have today's guest, Edward Hirsch, with us on the show. Edward is the president of the John Guggenheim Memorial Foundation and is the author of 8 books of poetry, including his most recent, The Living Fire, New and Selected Poems. He's also the author of numerous nonfiction books, including The Demon and the Angel, Searching for the Source of Artistic Expression, and a most unlikely bestseller, How to Read a Poem and Fall in Love with Poetry. How indeed. Let's get Ed on the show. Ed, welcome to Author.
Thank you, Bill. I'm glad to be with you. Nice to talk.
You know, Ed, part of the reason I got you on here is I was talking to Melissa Studdard, whose show you were on a little while ago, and she mentioned something you said to her, which is that no matter how much success you've had, you know, how many books you've published, how much acclaim, nothing will save you from the next poem you have to write. Do you remember saying that?
I know it to be true. I don't remember saying it, but I know it's the case.
I loved it. As soon as she told me you had said that to her, I said, I've got to get this guy on my show. I believe it 100%, but maybe some of our listeners don't know what you mean. What do you mean, save you from your next poem? You're a poet. Don't you love poetry? How do you need to be saved from it?
Well, you love poetry, and you try to live up to it, or you want to write it.
Yeah.
And you want to do your best, and you want it to be good, and you can't guarantee that. And you're bringing something new into the world, and you know, there's always that idea from Zen of beginner's mind.
Yeah.
And no matter how much experience you have, you're still facing the blank page. You're still facing the need to try and find a form for your feelings and your thoughts. You're still facing the dark truth that you're trying to confront. And you're trying to find a language for it. And the difficulty of it, the struggle of it, just it doesn't go away.
And you don't
it's
want it to
hard.
Go away, do you? Really?
Well, I think if it does go away, it seems to me you're probably not writing at a very high level.
Yeah.
I suppose there
true.
Are people for whom it goes away, but they're just on autopilot.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, it reminds me, there's a woman named Anat Bunyal who works with children both on the autism spectrum and with cerebral palsy and brain damage and all sorts of challenges. And she's been doing it for 30 years. She's a disciple of Moshe Feldenkrais. I don't know if you're familiar with Feldenkrais or not. But very brilliant woman, but very intuitive. And she said, you know, she sees client after client after client, and each one, it's like a blank page. It's a brand new person, a brand new experience, and she has to clear her mind and deal with them not like the one before, even though she comes, as you do, I'm sure, to the page with all your years of experience and all your facility with language and all your craft, still have to begin brand new with that moment, with that idea, which is different than the last one.
Yeah, there it is. Nothing's going to rescue from the process and having to go through it.
Yeah.
Sometimes I think you can bring some experience to it, which is to try to stay calm.
Yes.
And not panic and
yes.
Do the work and, you know, do the best you can.
Yeah, you know, I've gotten to speak to so many writers from, you know, writers like yourself who have had tremendous experience, writers who have, you know, published maybe 20 or 30 books, and writers who have just begun their journey. And the thing that seems to differentiate the more experienced writer from the inexperienced is what you just said. It seems to me the ability to know how to bring themselves back in alignment quickly when the fear comes in, because the fear will always come in a little bit, I think.
I think in addition to that, there's the sense, I think as you get more experienced, that you have a better sense that what's going in is also what's coming out. I think with young writers, inexperienced writers, that they sometimes think that, you know, they write it down and they feel the reader's going to get what that is, but often it can be very, very unclear. That was certainly true for me. And I think as you get to be a better writer, as you try, you gain some experience, that in the end, you get a closer feeling that what you're putting into it and the way you read it is a little closer to the way it gets read on the other side. And that's part of the, you know, that's part of the process of making it. But that's a different, you know, that doesn't save you from the act of having to make something and the work of making it and the joy of making it.
No, it doesn't.
You know, the oldest term for poetry is poesis, which means making. And to me, a poet is a maker and a poem is a made thing. And that's the joy of it, and that's the excitement of it, and that's the agony of it.
You know, it reminds me, so the name of the title of your last collection of poems, your most latest collection, is The Living Fire. And we always say we're making a fire, right? You go, you make a fire. But really, we don't make the fire so much as create an environment in which the fire can occur, right? I mean, we strike the match, but we don't physically build the fire. It happens, it is alive in that we allow it to come to life by putting the wood and separating the twigs and the fire, and so it can happen, but we ourselves can't hammer and nail fire into being. Does that make sense?
The fire has a life of its own.
Yes, and we allow it to occur. We help allow it to, we usher it. I feel like writing is the same way, that I kind of just create within me an environment that allows the fire of creativity, of writing, to occur.
I think there are two parts to this that you're talking about, and that's certainly true up to a point. That is, writing is not entirely rational, and it can't be entirely controlled by rational mind. And the thing you're talking about is creating a space for, you know, what in shorthand people call inspiration, but you can call it the unconscious, you can call it the uncanny, you can call it free association, whatever you want to name this thing that is not entirely in your rational control.
Right.
But something else also does kick in at some point. It's not entirely, you're not entirely just the vehicle of it. You're also a maker and you're also shaping it.
Absolutely.
And there's a kind of balance between the unconscious work of poetry and writing and the conscious work, which is the shaper. I mean, for example, you don't just unconsciously learn how to write a sonnet. You unconsciously, you know, shape, you know, start writing in a certain way and a poem starts to find a shape. But at a certain point, you make a decision that you want it to be 14 lines and you want the 14 lines to rhyme and the rhyme should work in a certain way. And the convention of the sonnet kicks in. And that part is not entirely unconscious. That part has to be somewhat conscious. And that's where craft comes to bear on the work.
And craft is so much the practicing, it seems to me in my own experience, of harnessing that creative, or I should say like this, it's that it's to some degree for me, I'm wondering if this is a way for you, is to learning what it is I do well and what I love to do and what seems to work for me and what I choose, among other things, but be best not to pursue. That certain approaches don't seem as comfortable for me. That so much has been about me learning how to write the way I want to write, express the way I want to express.
I completely agree. I mean, I think it's as good. It's important to have as many tools in the toolkit as possible.
Yeah.
And when you're a young writer, you should really try all different things and see what you can do, and try and learn your craft. And as you get more experience, you begin to discover that there are certain things you do really well and other things you don't do as well, and they don't seem native to your gift.
Yeah.
And so you begin to channel what you think you can do best and, you know, find something that's your own. I mean, you might love villanelles, and I think it's a great idea to try and write villanelles, but you may discover at some point that the villanelle is just not the form for you.
Yeah.
It's rigidity and its repetitions may just not be suited to your subject matter. And another poet may find, well, the villanelle is just the thing for me. So, but if you don't know what a villanelle is, if you're a poet, you don't know what a villanelle is, you can never harness it, you can never use it, you can never find out whether it's yours or not because you just don't know about it. And
yeah.
So I think it's important as a younger writer to discover a lot about your craft and your form and the history of your form so that it's so a lot of things are available to you.
I assume you've taught poetry over your professional life.
I have. I spent 18 years. I started teaching at Wayne State University. I started at Poets in the Schools teaching kids how to write poetry. And then I taught at Wayne State University for 5 years. And then I taught in the creative writing program at the University of Houston for 17 years. So, and then I've taught a lot of workshops. And I've had a lot of experience with workshops.
Do you enjoy the teaching of it?
I love teaching.
Why is that? I mean, because obviously a man's got to make a living, and teaching is a nice way to do it, but you actually love the act of teaching, and why is that?
Well, I think, first of all, I like to close the door and talk about poetry. And it's just not socially acceptable to talk about poetry for 3 hours at a time.
You can do it here, Ed.
I'm delighted to hear it. Most people start to go blank.
Yes.
And you can't just, if you really like to talk about your art, then the classroom is just a terrific place to do that because people are there for you to concentrate and you can really drill down.
Yeah,
and I like really looking at how poems work and taking them apart and putting them back together and thinking about them. And really how to read a poem grew out of my teaching. Some of the things I found myself saying and thinking about in terms of lyric poetry and the way I read poems in class seemed to be useful, and I decided to sort of try and teach a different kind of audience by writing about it. So I really like the problems. I like the issues. I like the craft. And then the other part is, writing is very lonely.
Oh, yeah.
It's really isolating. You have to do it, you're in somewhere inside yourself. I mean, if other people are around you, you have to dig deep. And the thing about teaching is you're with other people, and it's social. And it's nice to feel a community of people who are participating in the same project.
Yeah. And
whatever level they're on.
But don't you feel that every time I've done teaching of any kind, I always feel that I learn every time I teach. Not just how to teach, but I seem to learn what I'm teaching about.
Well, there's no way around it. I mean, your art form is inexhaustible.
Yeah.
And so you're going to learn things by the mistakes that people make, by the things they say, by some of their successes, by things you hadn't thought of. And so it gives something back to you. One of the great advantages of teaching literature as a writer, as well as teaching creative writing, is that, the works that you're writing about or you're teaching are inexhaustible. And so it also gives you something back. And I always bring texts into the classroom when we're doing creative writing because I think reading and writing are inextricably bound. My students are sometimes upset when I say you can't be a great writer without also being a great reader. But I think it's the case.
It is the case.
Well,
it's a strange thing. Every once in a while, I think in my hundreds of interviews, I've maybe met one or two writers who don't consider themselves voracious readers, but that's one or two. And the rest, it's just an automatic. It's a given.
I mean, I think that, first of all, I think sometimes people lie about that. And sometimes there are writers, I think, who are going just, they have maybe one book in them, a personal experience, maybe two at the most, just on based on their life story, which is so dramatic, that they can write something. But in my opinion is that if you're going to develop as a writer and create a body of work, not just your own single story from your childhood, say, you need to know something about your craft, and you can only find it out by reading. And I don't know, I think the reading for pleasure, reading for knowledge, the experience of reading overflows into the experience of writing. And in the history of literature, let me say more specifically in the history of poetry, which I know better, I can say there has been no great poet in the history of poetry who has not also been a great reader of poetry.
Yeah.
So I sometimes say to my students, well, you may be the first. I'm not saying it's not possible, but the odds are very heavily against you.
it does help. Well, I mean, I agree with you 100%. I think that you learn the language of it. You learn the rhythm of it. Well, there's so much you can learn from it. And
yeah.
you can be inspired
yeah.
from it, too. I remember I wrote a whole batch of poems as a young man, inspired really just by one couplet by Wallace Stevens. There was a certain thing he did in that little couplet. I thought, God, I would love to write a whole bunch of poems, and I did. It was enough, you know.
Well, if you had been my student, I'd say that's just what you're supposed to be doing. I mean, that's just what you're supposed to be doing as a young writer, is being inspired by what you read and then trying to do something off of it.
Yeah, just
I think that's how you find yourself and your subject.
Yeah. You know, speaking of which, so now I was thinking back to my young manhood in those poems, and I know as my life how as I've kept writing and things have changed and where different projects begin. And, of course, one of the interesting things about a poem, even if you do a lot of rewriting of it, they don't take as long to finish as a novel, by and large. You can write a number of them in a year, say. And so
yeah.
you have many ideas you can work with. And so as you've evolved as a poet, how has, if at all, where a poem begins evolved for you? Or does it always sort of begin in the same way?
No, I don't think it always begins in the same way. It never has always begun in the same way, although maybe when I was younger, I had things I wanted to write about, and it began with what I was writing about always.
Mm-hmm.
But over time, that changes, and I think that sometimes you have an idea that has to do with the way a poem can... a piece of language will come to you, or a metaphor will come to you, but also sometimes an experience that you want to write about is there. And for the poem to find its own life, its own figure, I'd say two things have to happen, no matter where it starts. It can either start with the form, or it can start with the subject. But for me, something important has to be at stake emotionally. And then, two, you have to find a shape. The poem has to find a form. It has to find an articulation. And when sometimes you just don't have the chops for that to happen, and sometimes you're just not emotionally ready. But when the
yeah.
two things are there, where you're emotionally ready to write about something, and you can find the form for it, then I think you can do something that you can live with.
Yeah. You know, one subject that comes up often with novelists, for sure, not all of them, but in some form or another, is money. The issue of money and how much
yeah.
they're going to make and how are they going to make it. And
that's
and
true.
On.
When novelists get together, they often talk about cash.
They do. It actually, it's
yeah.
true. It can come
yeah.
up a lot,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
And if you choose the field of poetry, even though obviously you write nonfiction books also, obviously one doesn't go into poetry necessarily to become rich, although anything is possible. And but
I don't think that one is, actually.
But I think it's worth talking about, because you make a choice knowing, and you can only do so many things in your life, and you make a choice that has what appears to be a certain limitation to it. Can you speak to that? Because I think it's important to talk about. Making a living, all that stuff.
I mean, you cannot make a living by writing poetry. You might make a living, piece together a living by teaching poetry. You might give readings, and that would help. There are probably two or three poets in America who can make a living by giving readings. But no one makes a living just by writing poems. And I think everyone knows that right from the beginning. And so it means you're going to have to do something else for your livelihood, for your job, for your work. But I believe that poetry is a calling. It's a vocation. And you'd be insane to go into it for the money.
Right.
You go into it because you love it and because you need it and because it's a way of giving you your own experience back. And so you want to spend your life with it. And I think that true poets decide, or it's decided for them, that this is what they want to do. And it's not really exactly a choice. You feel you have to do it. And then you try to cobble out a living in whatever way you can. And some people are very inclined towards teaching. Some people go off and become doctors or lawyers. Some people are in business.
Right.
People do all different things. But you cannot – it's true that there is the illusion or the fantasy I call it a fantasy for fiction writers now, because very few of them can earn a living by writing fiction anymore. But there were a lot who could, but now I think there are only a few. But there's still that illusion that you can earn a living by writing fiction, whereas in poetry you just can't. You have to do something else. And that's sort of something that compromises poetry, but it's also a kind of gift to poetry, because commerce is not involved.
Right.
It's not a commodity.
Yeah.
It's not a saleable thing exactly. I mean, you write books and you hope they'll sell something, but the idea of poetry is an exchange of gifts, and it's essentially free.
Yeah. It's challenging in a way, because I don't like to lay things on the culture, but obviously as you set out on your life, that question of survival really, is always hanging in, and it comes up in so many ways with writers again and again, because with artists, period. I always, when I teach people about the arts, I say, look, you know, the difference between the arts and every other profession, and I know people have done other professions, and I've done other professions, is you have to love it to do it and even have any hope of success at it. Unlike being a lawyer, you can have success at it and not particularly care for it. And that simply isn't an option with any of the arts, I don't think, and particularly poetry, where there isn't people clamoring to pay oodles of money for the next book of poems.
What's more is, you know, you have to have what Robert Frost called adolescent self-belief. You have to believe in yourself and commit to it long before you really have the evidence.
Yes.
And you may think what you're doing is terrific and you need to as you go, but it's going to take a long time. I mean, there are cases of people just flashing brilliantly forward, but most people it takes a while. And there's a kind of time of apprenticeship. And you have to throw yourself into it full, you know, you have to really go into it. You have to really commit yourself. You have to really do the work for it to pay off. And it might or it may not. And so you have to find your way through your 20s and your 30s, and every stage has its own challenges. But yes, in a materialistic culture, doing something as, you know, non-materialistic as poetry is really challenging. It certainly upset my parents when I declared that I wanted to be a poet.
How did that go? Because I've heard a lot of people talk about that, the relationship to the family, and that often there's a kind of, you know, shuddering breath, like, oh my, even if it's not poetry, it could be just fiction writing. Oh my word, what chance do you have? How did that go?
I would say that when...
Your father was not a poet, was he? Was he a salesman, is that right?
Yeah, my father sold corrugated cartons. I would say it went very badly.
Yeah.
It played very badly.
Was he an immigrant?
Yes, he was.
And so there was that whole, because my wife's grandparents had come over from during the pogroms, they came over, and so there was this huge strain of survival with them, of like, how do we survive, how do we do this, and that was really running through the family. And so it's a big thing for someone like yourself to step away and say, I'm going to do this thing which is not about, you know, making sure
there's a roof over my head. You know, I was the first, you know, you're a Jewish kid, I'm a Jewish kid from Chicago, the first one in my family to go to college.
Right.
You go to college, you struggle to get through college, and then you're going to take what you know, they think of as your smarts, and you're going to put them to use in writing poetry. Are you kidding me? We had a lot of titanic fights, and my compromise, my family didn't think of it as much of a compromise, but I thought it was a compromise, was I decided that I'd go get a PhD.
Right.
So I could teach, because I just wanted to write poetry.
Right.
But, you know, my family was very upset, and they were very upset for a long time. And I'd say that it lasted through my parents, it just lasted through my 20s.
Sure.
And they didn't stop being upset, I'd say, till I published my first book. But I was 31 by then.
Well, that's a long time.
So,
and you don't want to be doing it. You don't want to be writing it to spite them. You know, you can get confused. You're a young man. You're trying to establish who you are. And you don't want to do it just to show them. And you don't want to have the discussion of, like, am I doing this now because I actually want to do it, or am I doing it just because we had this argument and I don't want him to be right and me to be wrong? I would imagine all that could come swirling in, or maybe it was very clean for you.
That wasn't an issue for me, because I felt I had a calling to write poetry and that I wanted to spend my life with poetry. And, you know, I got that idea when I was in my teens, and I'm in my 60s now, and it never wavered. I just felt this was the thing for me. I don't know why. I feel it was like a raft that was going by, and I just grabbed on. I grabbed hold, and I needed it, and I wasn't going to let go. So I never felt I was doing it despite my parents, and that just was never the issue. But I did, you know, it helped my relationship with my parents when I got a job.
Yeah.
And I started getting fellowships for poetry. And I mean, after I left college, I didn't have any support from my family, so I was always financially on my own, which helped a lot. But, you know, you need a lot of faith and you need a lot of determination. And because it's a struggle, especially as you get older in poetry, especially you begin to see that the consequences of it mattering so little to the larger culture.
That I would think that would be challenging because obviously it isn't what when T.S. Eliot was publishing The Wasteland, it doesn't have that kind of resonance that it once did. There's so much else that's competing for airtime.
We live in a mass culture now, and you just can't underestimate the power of television and the constancy of advertising and the constant material buzz of everything that's around us. And poetry is going against the grain of that, and so you're going to be, it's a minority art, there's no question. And that can be very difficult. But that's been an American complaint since the Puritans, really, is the way art gets marginalized in our culture.
But I will tell you this, you described being a teenager and poetry coming by and you grabbing hold of it. And I'm sure it's been challenging and there's been the issues of money and your parents, but I will tell you, I would rather have that. I would rather be 16 and have the raft of poetry go by and whatever journey that takes me on than to not have something like that come by. Because you will reach a point in your life if you don't have that thing that you absolutely want to follow where you will wish to God you had it, even if it was just gardening or knitting or something that you actually care about.
I completely agree with that. I feel that I've been deeply lucky, deeply fortunate.
Yeah.
And I think anyone is really fortunate who finds their life's work. And if you find something that you love to do and you want to do it, whether it's writing or something else, and you spend your life doing that, I think you're a very fortunate person. I mean, if you really want to make chairs, and you can spend your life making chairs, then I think you're really fortunate. And I feel really fortunate that I found out I didn't waste a lot of years trying to do something that I didn't care about. I really loved poetry, and I wanted to be a poet, and I set myself forth, and I've been able to have the life I wanted. And I just feel that I'm really deeply fortunate that way. And if you're a writer and you teach a lot, you meet a lot of people who say, you know, I really wanted to write, but I needed to make a living, and I decided to go to law school, and I spent 25 years in the law, and I really hate being a lawyer, and now I want to write again.
Yeah.
And you just feel for those people. You're glad they found their way back, but you just feel like people were deterred.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot
of
that.
You're lucky if you haven't been discouraged.
Well, what a great note to end our discussion. Ed, this was too short. This was just awesome. Thank you so much.
It's just flown by. It's a pleasure to talk, Bill. I really enjoyed it.
Well, it was my pleasure as well. And again, everyone, it's The Living Fire. If you're going to buy one book of poem, why don't you get The Living Fire? And Ed, have a good rest of the 2012. I hope the world doesn't end for us.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
All right, bye-bye. Well, everyone, you hear that? You hear that? Do what you love. Do what you love. Have I not been saying this the last year? Yes, I have. If it's poetry, chair making, ditch digging, I don't care. Do what you love. You really can't go wrong. I will be here not next Tuesday. It's Christmas Day. I'll probably be celebrating Christmas. But next, the day after, Wednesday the 26th, I'll be with Randy Susan Meyer. Until then, take care and do what you love.